music you just heard was Harmonic Resonance by Jim Oliver. Jim's an old friend. Well, I shouldn't put it that way. I've known Jim for a long time. I'll put it that way. This is Sherry Edwards, director of the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, and your host for Sound Health on BBS Radio. Thank you for joining us. We'll get to our guest, Dr. Clyde Kitchen, an ophthalmologist and the author of Fact and Fiction of Healthy Vision, in just a moment. Stay tuned, because he promises to tell us about how some advertisers are taking advantage of us by making promises that's just a bunch of hype. We have three announcements this evening from the Institute. First, we're just starting a new project using vocal profiling for weight management. We found in a pilot study that a commonality for people who cannot gain weight is the amino acid carnitine. We're not sure what this means, but we want to begin to gather data about people who can't gain weight and those who can't keep it off. And I'm one of those. We want to hear from you, and we'll be doing another show around the topic of weight discrimination. For those of you who joined us last Monday, we will be doing a follow-up to that show on tomorrow's night show. That's another Sound Health review and weight management. The second announcement, we finished a pilot on macular degeneration with some promising results. We worked both with wet and dry macular degeneration and found commonalities of cholesterol imbalances for the dry macular degeneration. And for the wet, the commonality was an enzyme that dealt with the body's production of hyaluronic acid. We want to expand that study, and if any of you would like to be a volunteer, please get in touch with Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, at vocalprofiling.com. We have a new volunteer coordinator coming on board at the Institute, but Heather can get you in touch with them. And the third announcement they've asked me to let you know about, our free classes are still ongoing to teach people to do vocal profiling for health and wellness. They've been a fantastic hit, and please keep your comments coming. That's radio@vocalprofiling.com. Okay, on with the show. Dr. Clyde Kitchen, MD, is an ophthalmologist and has written a book about the eyes that's full of information about eye care for adults and children. Dr. Kitchen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Being an eye doctor and with all the people you see around with contacts and glasses, you must be very busy. Our audience here at BBS is very self-health oriented. They love information about themselves and their body, and we've had a lot of people who talk about health, but I don't think we've ever had an ophthalmologist on. Could you explain in simple terms what ophthalmologist is, does?
Well, an ophthalmologist is, first of all, a medical graduate of medical school who specializes after his internship in ophthalmology, which is usually 3 years, and as an ophthalmologist trained to treat all types of eye disease, or anything from glasses to surgery, in other words. And in the meantime, you know, treating pink eye and glaucoma, all the medical problems that can occur.
Well, in your book, the subtitle is Eye Care for Adults and Children. Is there a difference that adults should care for their eyes one way and kids another?
Well, there has developed a subspecialty in ophthalmology called pediatric ophthalmology, but actually a good general ophthalmologist, that's what I am, a general ophthalmologist, is able to take care of everybody in the family. As I point out, it's fun to be able to take care of the little kids with their crossed eyes and or if they need glasses, and then take care of Mama with her contacts and Grandpa with his cataracts, and we take care of the whole family.
Where are you located? Are you in a practice, an active practice now?
And I'm in Fullerton, California, and I'm kind of semi-retired. I've been in practice since 1964, and that's when I finished with my 2 years in the Air Force as an ophthalmologist. So I've been around a lot, and I guess you might generously say semi-retired.
Okay. So you don't want people to get in touch with you?
Well, I would be very much want them to do so if they want to learn something about the eye, because that's why I wrote the book. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when I talk to people, it's quite obvious that there's a lot to be learned, and it's not that difficult, really. And in doing radio interviews, I find through the questions that I feel even more happy that I wrote the book, because I need to spread some information. And this is not just among patients, but among other doctors. I talk to my doctor friends, and they don't know much about the eye either. And that's because they don't get much training. But a book like myself, which is not encyclopedia, it's written for the patient in common language, and
mm-hmm.
so that you can really understand what's going on.
It's a very easy read, very nice book. You wrote this, came out in May 07, and you said before the show when we were talking that you have found that even since the book, there's a lot of information that you'd like to share with people, and you're building a website. How would people get in touch with you through the website?
Well, I have to laugh at that, because that question's been raised about my website, and I point out, you know, I'm an old guy, but I'm working on it. So I am working on it, and it will be done, be published within a week or two. Another funny thing is that with the name of Kitchen and talking about eyes and vision, I couldn't even get ckkitchen.com. I had to go to ckkitchenmd.com in order to get a website.
So
that's what it is, ckkitchenmd.com.
Kitchenmd.com. We have archives of the show, and we will certainly put that up. C Kitchen.
CK Kitchen, just my initials.
Okay, it's two K's.
All my case, md.com.
Okay, we'll get that up. We do take calls from our audience, and so I need to give those numbers. For those of you in the U.S., the toll-free number is 877-876-5227. For those of you in Canada, toll-free, 888-815-9756, and the direct line, 530-876-3222. We are monitoring radio at vocalprofiling.com, and as always, soundhealth at soundhealth.org. Dr. Kitchen, who was you said the book is an easy read. Who did you specifically write it for?
I wrote it for the patient as a consumer. In fact, that was one of my original titles. I care for the consumer. So I want people to know what's going on when they hear these ads about somebody wants to correct their nearsightedness, farsightedness, astigmatism, presbyopia, and all this stuff. Just what are they talking about? And most people don't know. But if you read my book, I hope you will.
Well, I see a couple questions coming in already. Could you talk a bit about eye surgery? My husband's thinking about having LASIK surgery, but one of his friends had a really bad experience. More people had good experiences. What is LASIK surgery, and what's good and bad, or is it dangerous? Or
well, LASIK has become quite well developed, and a lot of new innovations. It's not something you have to kind of sit back and wait for something new to develop. But just to back off, it was discovered that you could change the shape of the eye with knives. That didn't work out too well, and then the laser. The most common problem, so to speak, that is approached with the LASIK is nearsightedness. A nearsighted eye is not a weak eye, as some people think it is. It's just bigger than average. And you can't shrink it, but you can flatten the cornea. So a laser was used to flatten the cornea, but working just on the surface, it peels off the surface epithelium, and it hurts like the dickens, a huge scratched eye for a few days. So then LASIK developed, which involved making a little cornea flap and actually lifting up the flap and putting the treatment underneath the flap, dropping the flap of cornea back in place without sutures, with instant, relatively painless results. That was a big hit right away, and both eyes could be done. However, there's a lot of misconception of just about, again, what you're accomplishing. For one thing, people think they're going to see better than they ever did. Not true. You're not going to see better than your best corrected vision would be, like with glasses or contacts. But if you, you know, can hardly see beyond arm's length without your glasses and want to see well without glasses, then it's kind of amazing to be able to see well like you could with contact lenses, only without contact lenses. And the main surprise, though, is presbyopia. That's where we all start to need some reading help by mid-40s, and it gets worse. And that happens to people with LASIK, too. So they are misled when they think that they're going to get their eyes so-called fixed and never need glasses. That's not true. But it can be quite rewarding. It's also true that there are people who shouldn't even bother if they're just a little nearsighted. So most of us aren't perfect, so why do you have to try to make it perfect when actually, you know, if you're a little nearsighted in your 60s and you can read in bed without glasses, because you're nearsighted, you have a lot of people jealous of you, you know. It's not so bad to be a little nearsighted as you get older.
Well, he wants to do it for sports, and he's just kind of on
sports,
the fence.
Sports, again, don't forget contact lenses. Contact lenses are a good option, and when you're doing it just for one thing, like some people want it, contacts for sports or for social occasions, and other times they don't, you know, they just didn't wear their glasses. Well, that person should be dealing with contacts, not be even considering LASIK. That's a relatively permanent situation, and with sometimes imperfect results, but usually pretty good. Nevertheless, the main thing is to do it to the right person at the right time.
Mm-hmm. You have a good write-up in your book about these different kinds of surgeries. So if people are thinking about that, they should just buy your book and read up on it.
Yes, and that's one of the areas where it's going. It's happening so fast that it's hard to keep up on. But in general, I think we discussed it or mentioned the term baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
The baby boomers are this group of people now 50, 60 years old, and they represent a big economic group which attracts attention, people selling this and that, including everything from eyeglasses to refractive surgery. Apparently this group of people has more money than previous generations, among other things. So there are some options to avoid glasses if you're really, really dead set into avoiding glasses, and that can involve anything from contact lenses to LASIK to having your lens of your eye removed, even though you don't have a cataract, and put a lens in that will focus at different distances.
Ooh,
that's kind of how far it has gone. And the latter is kind of far out, so to speak, right now, but probably we'll have some great advancements within the next few years.
I think part of it is one of his tennis buddy's wife is a eye surgeon, so that might be part of it. One of the things that I found very light and happy to read in your literature was some of these misconceptions about healthy visions, about carrots protecting you from going blind. Is that really true?
Eating carrots?
Yeah.
That is the number one question asked of me in these interviews. Are carrots really good for your eyes? Well, they won't hurt your eyes, but in general, they provide vitamin A, and vitamin A is stored in the body, so that it extra vitamin A is usually not necessary. A person would have to be starving for a long time before they would become short of vitamin A, and eating extra vitamin A does not improve your vision.
I have one that just came in that I have heard so many times before. Let me sort back to it as I was reading about it. I've been told, this is from an audience member, I've been told that everyone should have blue eyes and that any other color indicates that your eyes are full of trash. Any truth to this?
That your eyes are so what?
That everyone's eyes should be blue.
Well, there's nothing to that health-wise, but that's another title that I went through. Because it's a subject that attracts attention, there's no such thing as green eyes, is what I was thinking about calling my book. Because actually, you know, eye color has a lot to do with your genealogy, but eye color is determined by the fact that the back layer of the iris, which forms the pupil, is always black, like a blackout drape. But the front layer is very diaphanous and thin and irregular in surface, and it can be actually white. So white on the black gives blue. And then there are varying degrees of pigment, so that if you have a kind of splotchy pigment, you can actually have like little freckles. And if it's depending on how much pigment you have in the front layer, you go everything from blue to brown eyes. Somebody has a lot of pigment in the front layer has brown eyes. In between, we have hazel and so-called green and things like that. Green eyes apparently is such a fine dusting of pigment on the front surface that it's almost yellow. And yellow on blue gives green.
I have a yellow-eyed daughter.
Pardon?
I have a yellow-eyed daughter.
You do? Well, anyway, it depends on how much pigment there is in the front surface. And another popular myth is that your eyes, people say my eyes change color depending on what I'm wearing. That is total baloney. Your eye color is changed based on how big your pupils are. So if you have a little bit of pigment in the front surface of your iris and your pupils are small out in the sun, your eyes are extra light colored. I had a patient on pilocarpine who didn't want to give it up because her eyes were extra blue when she took her pilocarpine, made her pupils small. And then in a darker environment, your pupil gets big to let more light in, and that what pigment is in the front surface of the eye gets pushed together, and the eyes are relatively darker.
So there's no truth to it that darker-eyed people just are full of toxins?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. But there's a science called iridology, where people study the iris, colors, and so forth, and it's kind of like reading your palms. They tell you about your future and everything. And yet, in one of my interviews, I found out that the person giving the interview was an expert, so to speak, in iridology, so I had to watch what I was saying.
Well, in my daughter's eyes that are yellow, and I have a son that's green-eyed, and there's Elizabeth Taylor that has violet eyes, so this is just how thin or thick this front lens is.
It depends on how much pigment in the front surface,
And
how
that's genetic.
Finely distributed it is, or whether it's clumped together, and the size of the pupil.
Any truth to it that speckles, you're talking about speckles in the eyes, or it looks like holes in the lenses? I've heard iridologists talk about that. Any truth to any of that?
No, I call them freckles. I mean, you can have freckles on your iris, little spots, just like you have freckles on your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are said to have piebald iris, like a piebald horse. And that happens.
I don't know what piebald means.
Well, I don't either, except that it's a spotted horse.
Okay. looking at your book, you talk about the baby boomers, and you ask the questions, have your eyes retired? What's that mean?
Well, when we talk about the different definitions of the eye, the term presbyopia is a very important, but nobody can remember it. I think I saw what that means, you know, is age-related loss of focusing ability of the eye. It's called presbyopia. And I think I saw reference to the fact that even though informed, only about 80% of the people will remember what you told them when you define presbyopia. So I decided it would be easier to say your eyes start to retire in your mid-40s. Because it's the same thing. It's age-related. They start to retire whether the rest of you is ready or not. And then there are some factors involved, but the same presbyopia or retired eyes situation applies to everybody, whether you're farsighted, nearsighted, astigmatism, and so forth. The farsighted people are probably the most disappointed because they think the more farsighted they are, the further away they can see. But actually, they start to have trouble more than other people in their 40s because they have to focus even for distance. And so they end up eventually frequently not being able to see far away or up close, and they're terribly disappointed because they recalled when they used to see just fine.
We have a question that is here that came in around that. It says, I need more light to read. What causes that? I read well. I just seem to need more light, and I read best using light from above and behind me. Maybe, I think.
Well, there are a couple of things that are not, a couple of bits of information are not given here. First of all, does this person have glasses? And are they the right glasses? Because when you become presbyopic or your eyes begin to retire, you notice you need more light. You see people handing around flashlights in restaurants. You see people going over by the window to read something. It's because in good light, the problems in vision are not so obvious. And so that's one of the main things. And, of course, if there's something wrong with the eye, like a person has cataracts, they need more light. But the most common situation is a person is just not wearing the right glasses.
This doesn't say whether they have glasses or not. So does that mean that they're getting ready to need glasses if this kind of...
It could well be.
Light situation?
You know, that's another basic fact we need to spread, and that is anybody 40 and over needs to have an eye exam at least every 2 years. And it's not just to discover when you need reading glasses, but because things like glaucoma, macular degeneration, some of these other things begin to show up more commonly in that age group. So if they have been having regular eye exams, a question like that probably would already have been answered. For example, if they had cataracts, they'd been told they had cataracts.
And what causes cataracts?
Hello?
What causes cataracts?
It's age. We all get cataracts as we get older. I was defining presbyopia, mm-hmm. but I didn't exactly explain the cause. It leads to cataracts, actually. So as we get older, it isn't that our focusing muscles get weak, but the lens structure of the eye gets more rigid and does not respond to the same focusing effort that it used to. And the same process of rigidity of the lens eventually results in cataracts.
So
the cataract is age-related. We all get cataracts eventually, but it varies so much. Some get cataracts as early as 50s. That's quite young. But most, you know, if you have cataracts in 70s, 80s, 90s, that's par for the course. Others might have to be well into their hundreds before they had significant cataracts. But we all get cataracts.
Here's another question from the audience. Would you explain what is good or bad about extended wear contacts? Are they safe for children?
Well, in general, I wouldn't advise them for children. The usual reason for that is that the person doesn't want to go to the bother of learning how to take care of their contact lenses, and that person is dangerous. So it gets back to when you start contacts. Well, first of all, I think a child needs to be demonstrate the proper maturity that they really appreciate seeing well, and they demonstrate that by wearing their glasses. Then if they demonstrate to me that they wear their glasses but they don't want glasses, then we'll put them in contacts. Usually that's maybe age 13. We have lots of patients younger than that. Girls seem to do better than boys. I don't know if they're more mature but they are more dexterous or whatever, but they get into it. But the safest situation is a daily wear disposable soft contact lens. Extended wear contacts are available, but I would be very cautious about letting some young person go directly to that because that's probably just an irresponsible young person. They need to know how, if anything goes wrong, the first thing they need to do is take their contact lens out. They need to be very confident that they can do that, and they need to do that for a long time, every day, in the morning, out at night, and then if they've demonstrated through a period of years that they are doing very well, then they can try extended wear. But that's with this increased risk, and not everybody can wear extended wear soft contact lenses.
I have a question from your literature that I'm just remembering. It was about cataracts and improved visions by eye drops. And you said that's a bunch of hooey.
True.
Can you talk about that?
So we said a cataract is a clouding of the lens. Mm-hmm. And there are no eye drops that will remove the clouding of the lens. There are eye drops advertised as reducing the symptoms of cataracts, which is blurred vision. But there again, how is an eye drop going to improve blurred vision? Anyway, you'll see those advertised.
I'm asking about it because a question came in. If there are so many nutcases out there making promises and taking people's money, what's the best thing to do about that? And how come the government watchdogs are allowing it to happen?
Well, this gets into the broad subject of alternative medicine and so forth, and I'm not really qualified to go very far that way. But in general, there are not very many restraints on products that are said to be helpful, as long as it hasn't been proven that they've done any harm. They don't really have to prove they do any good.
Yeah.
And some of them perhaps do some good. But in general, there's not much control over that, and nor the advertising. In other areas, advertising exercises, which is a subject that's worth discussing. That's advertised all the time, too, and that's mainly a bunch of baloney. If you're nearsighted, exercises and your eyes are, by definition, bigger than average. Exercises are not going to make them smaller.
You can't reduce your eyes with exercise.
Pardon?
You can't reduce your eyes with exercise.
No.
Kind of like going on a diet.
Smaller. You can't change the shape of your eyes.
Yeah.
But that... it's been going on for years. The See Clearly method was one that was really advertised heavily not long ago, but I heard that they're in some trouble because of false promises. And that's, there again, occasionally people do run into trouble along that way if they can't prove what they're advertising is really true or really helpful.
So they could sell you water drops and... nobody could do anything about it. You just lost your money.
That's right, as long as you thought you were doing something and willing to pay the money.
I saw a booth at a health fair recently, and it was a guy that had written another I Get Better book about 10 years ago, and he had some new stuff out. And he was having people get really close to this a poster and follow these little rings and dots and stuff.
Yeah.
What's that about?
That's the same sort of baloney that's been spread around for years. It's all start with a guy by the name of Bates, the Bates method. And that's been shot full of holes several times, but people pick up the flag and start running again as, you know, the See Clearly method. That's all along the same line. And it's quite natural that they could say that they could make you restore your reading vision. But I've already pointed out that that's really not due to weak focusing muscles. But it's natural that somebody will try to sell you on that idea.
I don't know if you do any diagnosis, but we do have a couple of questions like that come in.
Okay.
My eyeballs hurt when I look up. What's up? That's cute, quick.
Well, there's not a whole lot of information there to go with it, but in general, it sounds like we're talking about somebody with both eyes hurt.
It says eyeballs. We ask our people to keep these very short because I have to weed through all of them while we're on the air.
Right. If the eye is red, of course, that would be very significant. Any kind of foreign body sensation under the lid is worse when you look up. And people with thyroid disorders have trouble looking up. But that person would have a kind of a bug-eyed appearance probably. And they might even see double looking up or trying to look up.
We'll just ask John to write back in and tell us. This is another question from Alex. How do you feel about surgery for cross-eyedness? My son is cross-eyed. He's 13. When would be the best time for surgery, or should he have surgery?
He's 13?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there again, I assume he's been under the care of an ophthalmologist. So the treatment of crossing of the eyes goes back to early treatment, usually preschool. if a child's cross-eyed, it's obvious there's something wrong, and the worst complication would be that the child would grow up with a lazy eye, an eye that doesn't see well. So people mistakenly call a lazy eye an eye that's not straight, but a lazy eye is an eye that doesn't see well, and the biggest cause is being cross-eyed. And the most common correction, the first thing to do is give the appropriate glasses. So most of these kids are farsighted. You put glasses on, their eyes will straighten out, at least to some degree. Then there are other things. Prisms are usually not so helpful, but just in general, we try to get the vision as good as possible, patching the good eye if necessary, get both eyes seeing well, get the right glasses, and they may even need to be bifocals in order to keep the eyes straight, not only for distance, but up close. And then if the eyes are still crossed, then we operate on the amount of crossing that's still there with the glasses on. So many people want their kids' eyes straightened so they're, you know, straight with the glasses off. And that's a mistake. So that child who had their eyes straightened so that they were straight with the glasses off will eventually be wall-eyed. The eye will drift out the other way. And I'm a little concerned about this child being 13 without knowing that he's had previous treatment. If he was going to be corrected for being cross-eyed, that should have been approached at an earlier age. It doesn't mean that it can't be done, but I'm wondering if this child already has a lazy eye.
Is this genetic cross-eyedness?
Well, it certainly can be. So that any parent or grandparent who is cross-eyed should have, those children should be checked by age 3 and watch very closely. The grandchildren or the children of anybody who is cross-eyed should be checked at least by age 3 and watch very carefully for the same problem.
And you certainly could notice that because by then the kids are tracking well.
Well, yes, being cross-eyed is usually obvious, but sometimes it's to a small degree. And then there are some situations where you hear, this is another question, fact and fallacy, can you outgrow being cross-eyed? Well, not really. But there are some kids who look cross-eyed who never were cross-eyed in the first place. And they, when their nose grows, they look like they grew out of there being cross-eyed and were never cross-eyed in the first place. So just in general, these things would be picked up by a good eye doctor.
Can you talk a bit for parents on how to look for a lazy eye?
Well, again, the child needs to be screened. A lazy eye means an eye that doesn't see well. And I think all children should be screened preschool. And if they don't see well, this doesn't have to be, this is an area of controversy. Some states are trying to legislate that you have to see an eye doctor preschool. That's not necessary. It's pretty expensive. And it also sometimes results in over-prescribing of glasses. But there are non-professional eye screening tests that are quite satisfactory. And the main thing is, if one eye doesn't see as well as the other, then that child needs to be identified and for sure see an eye doctor and get proper treatment.
I don't know if people really know what lazy eye is.
I mentioned they think it's an eye that's not straight. It's an eye that doesn't see well, even with glasses.
So
even with glasses, the eye doesn't see well. And this can vary anywhere from, being mildly the term is amblyopia, and it's that's a technical term. It's a lazy eye, and maybe only mildly out of focus, 20/40, for example. But it can be actually so bad as to be legally blind. And that's kind of a shame, mainly if something would ever happen to the good eye. These kids do remarkably well with one good eye, but they're at risk if they don't have two good eyes.
I know. I have a granddaughter who had a lazy eye, and it was, the way we could tell is the eye didn't track with the other one well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, again, mm-hmm. That's not a lazy eye. Lazy eye is when it doesn't see well. But the fact that it didn't track well should raise the attention that maybe that child doesn't see well in one eye.
Well, she was about a year old. She couldn't really tell us if she could see well or not.
She was how old?
About a year old, so she really couldn't tell us.
Well, when they're, as I say in the book, you can watch them for a while, but by the time they're 6 months old, if you still think their eyes are not tracking well, you should get them in to see an eye doctor.
6 months?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, oh. You know, they, because prior to 6 months, their eyes kind of wander around sometimes and they're, and end up all right. But if you don't even worried about it and you're 6 months old and you're still worried about it, then they ought to be examined.
Okay, this is kind of a long email here, and I'm trying to draw the pieces out of it. I guess the main question is, what do you think of corner eyeglass dispensers? I took a daughter in that couldn't see well. They wanted to test everyone in the family. Everyone got glasses, all three children and the mother. But the one son and daughter still couldn't see. We went to an eye doctor, and the younger son and daughter didn't even need glasses. What does Dr. Kitchen have to say about this?
What was the term for the corner eye doctor?
Or? Corner eye glasses dispenser.
Corner. Well, that might mean it's something like in the mall.
Yes.
Okay.
I would think.
Just in general, depending on the motivation, if we want to use that word.
Money.
You can find something wrong with everybody.
Yeah.
So, I hate to say it, but my dad was an optometrist. So anyway, I had reading glasses all through medical school, which I dutifully carried with me. And then when I became an eye doctor, started in training, I put them in a measuring machine, a lensometer. I couldn't believe there was practically nothing in there. So I threw them away.
Did you confront your dad?
Yeah. Well, it was just a matter of, you know, emphasis. He was giving me, I wasn't perfect, so I gave him his class. Anyway, I had different emphasis of training it where I was, and I knew that I didn't need them. But eventually, of course, like everybody else, I did need them. My eyes retired, and I'm wearing glasses now. So in general, yes, you can go to places that they'll sell you glasses that you don't really need. That's too bad. But that can occur.
How often should someone see an actual eye doctor and not just the corner glasses dispenser person?
Well, that corner glasses dispenser person term is a little misleading, too, because they're basically ophthalmologists and optometrists. So optometrists sometimes work for a place like Pearle Vision and so forth, and their job is to sell glasses, you know.
I wasn't going to give the name of what this lady said, so.
Yeah, anyway, in general, people are always not always happy with their glasses, no matter where they get them, whether from an ophthalmologist or not, but we all prescribe glasses. And I think you wanted to talk a little bit about the drugstore glasses.
Yeah, page 27 of your book, you talk about this rows and racks of drugstore glasses. So that was going to be my next question.
Well, it's a drugstore, or can be called over-the-counter glasses, because you can get them other places other than the drugstore, you know,
mm-hmm.
department stores, et cetera, and catalogs. In general, they come in different powers, and these powers can be of some use in understanding what's going on with the eye, too. But these glasses treat both eyes as if they're exactly the same, and that's not usually true. Most people have one eye a little different than the other. Also, that there is no astigmatism, and most of us have some astigmatism. So just in general, they're just kind of a rough roundabout guess about what you might need, but for many people, they work out pretty well. They start with a power of a plus one, which is about what a person who had perfect vision still for distance might need by mid-40s. And then by the time they're 50 or so, they're up to about a plus two. And in general, that's to see small print at 16 inches. The most powerful lens, the same person who still had perfect distance vision, would need to be about a plus 2.50. So that's kind of what would go on the bottom part of a bifocal, anywhere from a plus 1 to a plus 2.50.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, these glasses, what's wrong with them? Well, as I mentioned, they treat both eyes the same. It's kind of one eye fits, one size fits all. And the biggest problem is that a person gets these glasses and they say, oh, yeah, these work. And then they think they don't need to get an eye exam. So that's the biggest mistake. Because the same reason their arms are getting too short and their eyes are retiring is that they're old enough now that they need to worry about glaucoma, or at least be checked for it, macular degeneration, and some of these other things. And most people will be pleasantly pleased to find out that they're just fine. But in the process, they will be checked for glasses, too, and they will be advised whether the drugstore glasses are right for them and so forth. But this is discussed in my book quite a bit, too.
I have sort of a funny question for you. This is a question for Dr. Kitchen. Is your book available at libraries yet? I just looked up your book on Amazon, and the price is hefty, nearly $50. Most of us can't afford that much for a book. Can you give us a brief overview so I can talk my wife into letting me buy this one?
Well, because it's something you can hang on to. You can read it to learn what's going on. And then hang on to it, because if you forget something, it's a reference book. And I apologize for the cost, but in general, I think it's kind of like a Merck manual of the eyes. It's something to hang on to, have around, and use it as a reference.
Well, can you talk a bit about the chapters that are in there? There's chapters on surgery. There's chapters on care and what you talk about. I mean, it's your book. Just talk about, in general, what the book has in it.
Well, we start out by defining the anatomy of the eye, and so that you can understand, again, what it means to be nearsighted, farsighted, and so forth. And then how vision develops, including the fact that babies don't see so well when they're first born. And what happens when we examine the eyes, why we dilate the pupils, not just to be mean, but so we can see inside, and go over things like glasses and contact lenses, what it means to be legally blind, and what's 20/20, what's that mean? And then we go through some common eye problems, everything from a red eye to itchy eyes and lumps and bumps of the eyes and being cross-eyed, wall-eyed. Then, as you're pointing out, getting old ain't for sissies, so we talk about age-related problems. Included, number one, is presbyopia. We've been talking about that. Cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration. Then we get into some things a consumer needs to know about visual aids. Also diabetes and why they should be, diabetics need to be checked every year. Things that can happen neurologically, including sudden loss of vision and seeing double vision. Then we get into things like LASIK and what's going on with refractive surgery. And we talk about what happens in eye surgery that can be kind of scary, but we kind of describe that a little bit so you know what's going on. What's a corneal transplant, for example? And then at the end, I talk about differences between ophthalmologists and optometrists and what you can expect your insurance to pay for eye care. And some things that we might expect to happen in the future in eye care.
We did have, you talk a little bit about medications, too, in here. And we have a couple of three medication kind of questions. Let's go to those. I keep getting red bloodshot eyes. A friend told me to take an amino acid, lysine, and it worked. When I don't take the lysine, the red eye stuff comes back. Is it just a coincidence that the lysine seems to take away and keep away the red inflamed eye? It looks like my eyes are bloodshot.
Well, it sounds like if it works, go ahead. I haven't really been aware of that as being commonly an advantage for red eyes. There's so many different kinds of red eyes, and sometimes we're kind of stuck to explain why. Some people have kind of dilated blood vessels in the conjunctiva, the outer layer of the eye, and it's kind of like varicose veins, and our eyes just get red real easy from all kinds of things. So, in general, I would say if that doesn't sound to me like that's anything that's going to do any harm, just go ahead and use it. I just hadn't been aware that works.
Here is an odd one. I heard that bathing your eyes in coconut water heals cataracts. Can you comment? Is there any truth to that? And if it isn't true, how can such misinformation be allowed to be disseminated?
Well, that's a good question because I've never heard of it before. And I think, again, when you think about it, it doesn't make sense. So coconut oil, I don't think, I wouldn't even advise putting that in the eye just for concern about what irritation it might cause. So
it's coconut water. Not coconut oil, but coconut water.
Coconut water, it's still got chemicals in there.
Is it the same thing?
In there.
Oh, yeah. Here's a nice one from information for the guy who thought the book was too expensive. I saw on Amazon that there are several copies for around $7 used on Amazon. Try that. Okay?
Yeah, that's kind of a annoying surprise to me. I think that's negative advertising. But from what I found, from what I understand, first of all, I can't understand because anybody who has the book ought to keep it for reference. You don't just read it and turn it in like your latest novel. And secondly, I find that apparently there are outfits that buy up promotional books. You know, we send a lot of these books out to promotional to newspapers and places, and apparently they sometimes just kind of get handed back under the table to some of these guys for a buck, and they sell them for $10. Which is a real disappointment, you know.
Well, I certainly am going to keep mine. Here's a very nice question. I see a lot of ADD kids and mentally challenged kids who have eye problems. Do you believe the two go hand in hand? And this is somebody signed her name. It's a lady named Maud.
Well, there are many, you know, problems in learning development. And sometimes the child is, for example, has Down syndrome, and that they have eye problems. And in general, I would not be surprised to find the incidence rather high in mentally disadvantaged children of the whole group, but I don't know of any particular connection to ADD, for example.
Okay. I'm trying to give you a good question, strange question, kind of mix them up here. This is a strange question. When I travel to England, I no longer need my glasses. As a matter of fact, I can't use them at all. They make my vision worse. Can traveling on an airplane make vision better, or does being in a different environment affect your eyes?
Well, boy, I don't have an answer to that. Traveling can make your eyes dry out and be irritated, but it doesn't, you know, change the shape of your eye. And that doesn't change your need for glasses. I do find that the English are among those who are in particularly, they want a separate pair of distance glasses and a separate pair of reading glasses rather than bifocals. But other than that, I have no idea what could be different in England about needing glasses.
Well, maybe England's the only place this person went, and it's something about the airplane or something.
Maybe.
Don't they pressurize cabins? Is the eyeball pressurized?
Well, I think the main complication in air travel is the drying out effect on the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other problem.
Okay, another question. This is probably the most questions we've ever gotten on a show. Is common oils like sunflower and canola oil bad for the eyes? Bausch and Lomb, puts out lutein with salmon oil. Is that good for the eyes? What kind of eye problem would need lutein?
Well, there was a study that showed that certain vitamins, including lutein and zinc, will help age-related macular degeneration of the dry type.
Okay.
Actually, the help is not as much as you might hope. It only reduces the advancement to late stage by 25%. But it's still worth advising it and doing it if you have dry macular degeneration because it may help.
When we were doing the study on macular degeneration and we looked at Bausch and Lomb lutein, there were some that had a base of canola oil. And then there were several articles that said something like canola oil is actually bad for your eyes. So the people
I'm not
that,
familiar with that.
I'll try to dig that up again. I didn't do the actual digging for that literature, but I had it handed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were on, it was a study, they'd been on lutein that was based in canola oil, and their vision actually got worse.
Well, there are so many different factors that you have to have a huge study and take, you know, go by big group to make significant percentages because you do so-called anecdotal studies, and somebody can get better and somebody can get worse, and to blame it or give credit to what they're taking might be a big mistake because the eye... The process of macular degeneration itself is so variable. The dry kind is not inevitably blinding. You may have macular degeneration and only be, you may never quite lose your driver's license, or at least fight to keep it, but and then you might become legally blind. But if you do, you're not going to be somebody who needs help getting dressed or self-care or getting around because they retain their travel vision, their peripheral vision.
Mm-hmm. We have another one come in from John. That guy says, my eyeballs hurt when I look up. He says, it's the muscles. It feels like my eyeballs are tired, like my legs get tired when I run. I can feel the muscles, but I couldn't feel them before.
Hmm.
Is that
the same person?
Pardon?
Is this the same person?
This is the same person, same email address.
Okay.
So I think you had said something about we don't have enough information, so he sent some more.
Okay. Well, there are some things that fatigue, like in myasthenia gravis, muscles fatigue easily, and that can include eye muscles. But certainly the large muscles in the legs and the arms would show signs of easy fatigue.
Okay. Well, here's an insurance question. I think we've covered all these. How come insurance is cutting back on paying for glasses and eye care? Don't you guys have a lobby or something that could make it stink about this?
Well, first of all, insurance never used to cover glasses at all.
Ah, didn't know that.
And glasses, that's not part of health care. But what happened is, along with the union plans, the unions wanted health care, and so then they wanted eye care, and then they wanted dental care. So there's so many plans, including government employees, schools, and everything, and there are also eye care plans that any employer can purchase for his employees, which provides an eye exam every year and glasses every, say, 2 years, and people get used to that. But that's a special plan. It's not part of a basic health insurance. And where it comes to be a real problem is as people get older and become eligible for Medicare, then they, and say they, before retirement, had an eye care plan where they work, and now they find out Medicare doesn't provide for glasses, and that can stimulate a question like this person has. But basically, insurance never was intended to cover eye care. It's just these additional plans evolved, and now, as a result, because people complain, the HMOs have, and senior plans frequently do include eyeglasses and eye exams, but then you have to give up your Medicare and go to the doctor in that HMO that may not be the one you selected yourself.
I'm surprised to hear you say that eyes aren't health care. I would think they would be.
Well, they are in health care. Like, for example, the I'm just talking about glasses.
Okay.
And let's further explain that. Being checked for glasses, the government considers a routine exam, and they don't cover routine exams. But if you have cataracts or glaucoma or just about anything health-wise wrong with the eyes, yes, they do cover it. But this is also mentioned in my book. It's paradoxical that they will not cover the part of the exam for measuring your vision. And yet we don't know how bad your cataracts are unless we measure your vision. So it's really a very distinct, important part of the exam, and yet Medicare wants to carve it out. So to, you know, Medicare patients, they want to know why they have to pay this money up front.
Well, we're out of time.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you about a good diet for eyes and other questions. It's Dr. Clyde Kitchen, Fact and Fiction of Healthy Vision. I'm sure you cover nutrition in your book, and they can get it at Amazon and other outlets. Or can they get it from you?
They should get it from their regular bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders.
Okay.
All the good bookstores are through Amazon and Internet. These places also sell it over the Internet.
Thank you so much for being with us. For those of you who want to know more about Dr. Kitchen, we will post his new website on the archives on BBS Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Kitchen.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
Good night.
Bye-bye.